KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting for this week's public health updates on COVID-19, live from the Jefferson County Courthouse. This is KPTZ, Fort Townsend.
There was a time in public comment where that wasn't true. And so it can have a bigger life.
Yeah.
And bigger responsibility because of it.
I would say that preventative antibiotics, though, on animals, that is a bad thing. There's some truth even in that. I mean, that's the frustrating thing about many of these misinformation themes. When it hits on something that resonates with you too, it's real easy to say, industrial meat is evil. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't take the coronavirus vaccine when it comes out.
Oh, the best lie is to have a springboard from the truth.
Yeah. All right. Well, it is 9:45, so unless there's any last comments, we will welcome the listeners from KPTZ and Dr. Locke and Willie Vince, our Director of Emergency Management, and we'll pass it off to you. I think I welcome the listeners of KPTZ. So, Dr. Locke, how are we doing? It's vaccine week, right? Give us some good news.
Yes. Well, we do have some good news, but first, the bad news, and that is the epidemiology of the COVID-19 pandemic. So in the U.S., nationally, actually yesterday, just to give an example, there were 184,000 cases of COVID-19 diagnosed. And this is actually a third of the cases in the entire world. About 500,000 cases were diagnosed yesterday. So the U.S. has been impacted in a way that no one would have predicted, and far in excess of really anywhere else in the world. Cases in the U.S. are up by 30% in the last 2 weeks, and as we grimly predicted, the death rate is going up. It's now on the verge of exceeding 300,000 deaths. That rate is actually up by 67% compared to the prior week, which likely represents the impacts of the Thanksgiving holiday. And on Wednesday of last week, we exceeded the milestone of there were over 3,000 deaths in one day. Prompting comparisons to 9/11 or Pearl Harbor, which had less mortality, each of those events. So a very grim scene nationally. The here in Washington State, we're averaging around 3,400 cases a day. That's up 28% from the prior week. And the statewide case rate is 460 per 100,000, and 15.3% of tests that are being done are coming back positive. That's one of the highest positivity rates ever. And in some areas of the state, the rates are almost double that. In Spokane, the case rate is over 800 per 100,000. Here in Jefferson County, the numbers are much better. In fact, I looked, we are the third lowest county in Washington State in terms of COVID rates, third only to San Juan County has the lowest, Garfield County in the southeast corner of the state is also very low. So our rate was 110 per 100,000. We've now dropped to 94 per 100,000, and the positivity rate is around 2.3%. And we'll recalculate that today and get an updated number. And so our cumulative case count is now up to 195. In Clallam County, their rate is currently at 180 per 100,000 and 5.5% positivity. And Kitsap is at 212 per 100,000 And they can't actually calculate their positivity rate now because the state system that they use to track negative tests has been overwhelmed. So they're having to recalculate that, and that will go, they'll catch up with the backlog sometime this week. But that just reflects the huge volume of testing that's being done in the state. As you mentioned, the very good news is this is the week that the Pfizer vaccine is shipped and vaccinations begin. There's already been some vaccines administered on the East Coast. What we're told is there will be about 3 million doses will go out this week. Today to 145 sites, tomorrow to 425, and then another 86 on Wednesday. And one of those very likely will be Jefferson County. Jefferson County has been assured we will receive a shipment. We don't know. It's very unlikely to be today, but sometimes Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday. Jefferson County, also Clallam County, is getting one. And these are going directly to the hospitals. Given that this is a very difficult vaccine to store and thaw and reconstitute. So it requires ultra cold refrigerators and things that generally only hospitals have. And this is the case over most of the country. Most of this initial wave of vaccinations will be through hospitals. The prioritization for this first wave, these have been set. There are guidelines that are developed by the Centers for Disease Control, but the ultimate decision is at a state level as to how to prioritize the vaccine. And so Washington State, like most states, has created what's being called the 1A prioritization group. And this is frontline healthcare workers, people whose jobs require them to work within 6 feet of other people, and those people are have COVID disease or at risk of having it. Frontline first responders, paramedics, EMTs, and the staff and residents of long-term care facilities, which have been very severely impacted. That population, staff and residents of long-term care facilities are about 1% of the U.S. population, but they've been 6% of the COVID cases, and 40% of the mortality has been in long-term care. So that's a high priority target. And the Jefferson County Public Health and Jefferson Healthcare has been working almost nonstop for the last 2 weeks, daily meetings, a lot of weekend meetings to get ready for the vaccine. We did a full walk-through tabletop exercise, a three-hour exercise on Friday to just debug the process. So I can't say enough for the diligence and dedication for Jefferson Healthcare staff in terms of getting ready for this. It looks like Jefferson County will be able to, through the county or the hospital supply, will be able to vaccinate the workers at long-term care facilities. And then there's another dedicated vaccine supply that's coming for the residents that will come through the pharmacy system. Walgreens and CVS will be responsible for vaccinating the residents. And we're thinking that will come next week. So the national plan with the Pfizer vaccine is to, and actually a second vaccine made by the Moderna pharmaceutical company, which is likely to be approved by the end of this month. The plan is to vaccinate about 20 million people this month. That's the hoped for goal. And then an additional 100 million in the months of January and February. And that's based on these two messenger RNA vaccines. And you know, I would describe this as, you know, this is a time, it should be a time of great hope, but it's also a time of great peril, because we are going through what we will look back on as the worst period of the pandemic. The greatest number of cases, hospitals being filled to capacity, the highest mortality rates. Already, 1 in 10 Americans live in an area where the hospitals have no ICU beds available, where the ICUs are at capacity, and that process is just starting. The vaccine will be in very short supply. That is to say that the demand will far exceed the supply, likely for the next 3 months. And during that time, although the exact priorities have not been finalized in a detailed way, the general priorities for Washington State have been set. And it's going to focus on critical workers, food production workers, others that kind of keep society going, groups that are at high risk for COVID complications by virtue of age or medical conditions, essential workers like teachers and law enforcement and government workers. So we're thinking that it won't be until late March or April before this vaccine will be generally available, where you can go into any doctor's office or any pharmacy and get a dose. The first two vaccines, they're complex to administer. You have to have a second dose. We're told that the timing has to be fairly precise for that second dose. So we're shooting to have it exactly at 3 weeks for the Pfizer vaccine, and it's 4 weeks for the Moderna. And we're going to be doing this at a time where the pandemic will be raging. It will be getting worse. We fear that will be fueled by holiday gatherings and travel, time spent indoors during the winter, and just the nature of this infection, which has very high rates of asymptomatic infection. So you never really know who's infected or who is not. So, and as I heard a little of the discussion earlier, we are a divided nation. We're a nation where a lot of people are still in denial as the nature of this pandemic and the severity of it. So I'll just close this section commenting on holiday plans. Our recommendation, as with Thanksgiving, is people really look long and hard at their holiday plans. And really, my recommendation is holiday gatherings should be household only, and that people should really avoid interstate travel and international travel, especially. You know, it's very tempting to go to Mexico right now. Mexico is open to U.S. visitors. Mexico is not safe. We just had a couple come back from their Mexican vacation, both infected with COVID-19. So it's still raging in Mexico, and strongly recommend against that. For those who choose to travel over the holidays or get together, limiting the amount of travel, limiting gathering size, being especially cautious if you have college students who are coming home for the holidays. Ideally, they should be tested before they leave their campus. They should stay in quarantine and for at least 7 days, and then they should be retested. Is the ideal, tested after about 5 days of returning from school. And anyone who travels or comes back from school needs to watch very carefully for symptoms and be tested at the first sign of symptoms. This is with the caveat that testing sites really have limited capacity for travel-related testing. A lot of our testing capacity is being used to evaluate people with symptoms and evaluate people who have exposure to confirmed cases. And those two groups are our highest priorities. So that's it for my kind of overview. And then I have 14 questions from KPTZ this week, down from 22 last week. So definitely more manageable. And the first asks I'm not sure if this is hypothetical or if someone's real plan, but if two households of four people are planning to isolate for 7 to 10 days and then get tested at day 7 for a small gathering, does that mean we can gather indoors safely without masks? And then it further adds that two have previously had the virus since March. And the way I'd respond to this, there's no absolute safe thing to do, but there are ways to reduce risk and reduce risk potentially to very low levels. Probably the lowest risk you can achieve through isolation and testing is to isolate for at least 7 days and then test. Use a sensitive PCR test at about day 8. And wait till you get the results. So if you test negative at around day 8 and then stay in isolation until day 10 and have no symptoms, you're at the lowest achievable risk of having COVID-19 at that point. It's not zero, but it's less than 0.5%. And then in terms of confirmed past infection, we have good evidence that people are immune for at least 3 months after infection, but beyond that, it becomes more and more uncertain. Maybe that people are immune for up to a year, but it's just not known. So infection back in March is not reliably protective 6 months later. Second question asks, are the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine studies public? And the answer is yes for the Pfizer study. Essentially, everything became public last Thursday. So it's on the FDA website. There's links on the CDC website. So there's a lot of very detailed information about their clinical trials that they had to submit in order to get their emergency use authorization, which came through last Friday. The Moderna vaccine clinical trials have been completed. They apparently are going to apply for their license in the next week, and they're anticipating shipping vaccine at the very end of December. And theirs is a very similar vaccine to the licensed Pfizer vaccine. There's a question that asks, do our local hospitals have the monoclonal antibodies, dexamethasone, remdesivir. And I was on a call with the hospital incident management today, so I had to ask about the antibodies. And the answer is yes. So they have all of those. They have monoclonal antibodies. They've had a stock of remdesivir for some time. And dexamethasone is a very common drug that we use in hospitals all the time. So definitely a supply of that. So all of those treatments are available locally. There's a question I don't fully understand, but I'll take a crack at it. Could you settle the issue of excess death rate due to COVID-19? My neighbor keeps telling me there's no difference between death rates we normally see and the added extra due to COVID-19. First of all, the official mortality rate for COVID-19, which is now almost 300,000, these are confirmed deaths due to COVID-19. These are people who tested positive, usually went through a serious illness and failed to recover, died from it. So these are absolute certain deaths. In addition to that, We only have these numbers through the end of October, but there was a study done And 299,000 Americans died between January and October of 2020 in excess of what would have been predicted. So these are the so-called excess deaths. And for other reasons, it's thought that up to two-thirds of them died of COVID-19, undiagnosed COVID-19. So there's potentially another 200,000 non-confirmed deaths for COVID-19. This is based on statistical modeling. This is the so-called excess death rate. So what we know for certain is that the confirmed death rate for COVID-19 is an undercount. It's not an overcount. And the true rate is probably much higher, but because these were there was no evaluation done in these deaths, we'll never know for sure. But that's if you Google excess deaths, you'll get a CDC publication that explains this in detail.
Dr. Locke,
yeah.
Can you go on a little more just into the concept of dying from COVID-19 and dying with COVID-19, you have underlying conditions that, I think the example in the letter today was about, you're in hospice and then you get COVID-19. I mean, we're all going to die eventually, right? But, can you just talk about that correlation a little bit?
Right. There is a distinction. On when we have a confirmed death, it should be from COVID-19, not just with, and it is possible to have it and die of something else, so we try to sort those out, and in the death certification process we try to be very specific, with the in the area of excess deaths. That's kind of a different sort of thing. Those are estimates. We don't know for sure. But there has been this kind of social media as part of the whole hoax mythology that we're exaggerating the death rate, that people who die of gunshot wounds or motor vehicle accidents who test positive are somehow counted. And that's just simply untrue. This is most of the unaccounted COVID deaths are people who died at home. They developed illnesses. They did not seek medical care, and they had high risk conditions, and they died without anyone ever determining the exact cause. But we do know for sure that. More Americans died in this last year than we would have predicted based on other projections. Another question, what are the best websites to get information about COVID-19, vaccines, epidemiology? Certainly the CDC is still the best site. And pretty soon, the CDC is going to be back in the driver's seat as a sort of the national public health agency. If you track the CDC carefully, they've been unmuzzling themselves week by week. They've taken a back seat to the White House, but that's changing. And so we'll have them back. The World Health Organization has a very good website if you want to look at the world picture. Department of Health has a good website, but they're really having trouble keeping up with the data. So their data is not as accurate as the county-based sites. And then I've been extremely impressed with these New York Times and Washington Post. They actually have some of the most up-to-date information of anyone. So those are good, reliable sources. Question asked, can I explain why some people get both positive and negative test results on the same day? What's the most accurate test? Can you compare that with antibody testing or antigen testing? And the way I'd answer that is that there are really two major types of tests for COVID-19. One is called the molecular testing, and it involves looking at the genetic material from the virus, the RNA from the virus. It usually uses a technology that amplifies that genetic material to the point that it can be detected. And these are the most accurate tests. Most often this is referred to as the PCR test, but there are some other tests besides that. And then there's the antigen test or the rapid test. And these detect proteins that are distinctive for the SARS-CoV virus, and they're very rapid. They're 15-minute tests. They're less sensitive, so they're less accurate. And to understand why it can be, go back and forth between positive and negative, it's important to understand that when you get infected with the virus, at about day 3 to 4, the virus starts rapidly multiplying in your system. So at first, the PCR test will be positive and the antigen test will be negative. And then both tests will be positive. And then after you start to recover, the antigen test will be negative again, but the PCR can stay positive for several weeks after your infection, actually well past your point of being contagious. So each test has pros and cons. And if people, none of them are 100% sensitive, so they won't pick up all cases, and they're not 100% specific, so they can have false positives. So, and this is true with all diagnostic tests. So tests have to be interpreted in the context of other factors, exposure risk and whether you have symptoms and where you are in the course of illness. But we can usually figure out on a case-to-case basis, we can figure out whether someone's infected or not. There was a question asking if the uncomfortably large, long-stabbing Q-tips are being used for COVID-19 testing, and fortunately, those have gone by the wayside. The nasopharyngeal swab that people liken to having a brain biopsy, these are almost never used anymore. We've switched over to a special technology swab, which you kind of rotate in the front part of your nose. So you do it 20 seconds on each side, and it's usually self-collected. So if you go to drive-through, they'll hand you a kit, and you kind of swab your own nose, and then put the swab in the test kit, and then give it back to the person at the drive-through. Testing is very comfortable and non-invasive. There even are some places doing saliva testing. That's an alternative, although we're not currently using that in Jefferson County. Then I had a question, what's the best way to stay safe on a long flight? You certainly want to use a high-efficiency mask, number one, so a KN95 or N95. Some sort of eye protection is beneficial. You need to use really meticulous hand hygiene. You need to assume that all the surfaces in the aircraft and in the airports are contaminated, so don't touch your face unless you've washed or sanitized your hands. And what a lot of people don't realize is one of the most dangerous places in with air travel is not the flight itself, but it's getting on and off the aircraft. So it's crowding in the jetway or when you're in line or if there's lines at the airport. That's where a lot of the risk is. And it's thought that direct flights are probably safer than connecting flights. And it's mostly because getting on and off the aircraft multiple times is a risk factor. There are some studies, too, that say very long flights, so flights that are over 8 hours, are riskier than shorter flights. So some of the transcontinental flights can be higher risk. A question asked, I have observed that exhaled cigarette smoke seems to carry quite a distance. If you breathe in exhaled cigarette smoke from someone who is infectious with COVID-19, are you breathing in those droplets carried on the smoke plume? Smoke is different than droplets and aerosols. First of all, smoke is sort of a very small, dry particulate material, whereas the infectious particles that we put out with COVID-19, the droplets are actually quite large and heavy and don't travel very far, 3 to 6 feet maximum. So they would not travel the same distance as the smoke plume. Aerosols, though, are a different matter. Aerosols are very small. They float in the air, and they can travel farther than 6 feet. There was just a study published this week of transmission that was documented in a restaurant 20 feet from the source case. We think that's fairly rare, but it can happen. These very small aerosols can travel the same distance as a smoke plume. One of the few saving graces about aerosols is because they're very small, they don't have a lot of virus particles in them. So you're much more likely to get a high dose exposure from a droplet exposure than from an aerosol exposure.
Can I ask a follow-up on that? I'm just curious, there's different fluid dynamics for an aerosol or the smoke. So would it necessarily be associated with the smoke? Say someone, 15 feet away from me is smoking, they exhale the smoke, I inhale the smoke. Does that mean that any aerosols are with that smoke, or might it have gone a different direction based on the fluid dynamics in the wind?
You would expect them to behave differently. The aerosols are still heavier than the smoke particles. And then in addition to the smoke that people can see, which is the particulate matter, there are other things in smoke that people can smell, which are actually not the particles. They're what are called esters, and they're kind of volatile organics. And they go an even longer distance, and aerosols would not follow that pattern at all. So the smoke and the aerosols are independent, but the only thing they really have in common is that they can go significant distances, and that's why masking and distancing is so important, because masking is a very effective way to trap both droplets and aerosols. A question asked about doing wastewater analysis for COVID-19 and whether that might be valuable. And there are a number of studies that have looked at this on small-scale settings, like, for instance, university dormitories. And it is of utility. If you can kind of tap into the waste stream of a defined group, and then COVID appears in that group, you can test everyone in the dormitory and find out who has the infection. For using it for a whole municipal wastewater system is of some value just to track the general trends, but at this point, unfortunately, virtually all municipal wastewater systems would have some COVID-19 in them, and usually the tests are not what's called quantitative, where they measure the exact amount and therefore you can predict how much disease there is. They're more qualitative tests where they just tell you yes, no, is it present or not. So we're not seeing that used much for municipal water sources, but it is a valid technology. There's a question, to what extent does the vaccine actually prevent infections versus simply preventing clinical illness? That's an excellent question and not completely answered as of yet. What we know from the 22,000 people that took the Pfizer vaccine is that they had a 95% reduction in clinical illness, and of the small number, it was about 19 people who got the infection despite the vaccine, if I'm recalling the numbers right, only one had serious disease. So there was also a reduction in severity of disease. But what we don't know is how much reduction in contagiousness there was. Some vaccines prevent people from spreading an infection to others. Other vaccines don't do that. You know, the pertussis vaccine, for instance, does not prevent you from getting severe pertussis, whooping cough, but it doesn't prevent you from spreading it to other people. So we don't know the answer to that yet about this new vaccine. It probably does substantially reduce the contagiousness of someone because it prevents the virus from multiplying in your system. But that's an important question we're going to have to answer, and we'll only know it when a much larger groups of people have been vaccinated and we study them and we see, you know, what kind of viral loads they're carrying. There's a question if you have it sort of asked if you have proof of vaccination, can you go indoors at restaurants and movie theaters? Will there be incentives for vaccination? And certainly everybody who gets vaccinated will have an official record of it. There's in fact a kind of a cell phone version of proof of vaccination. You'll get a card. But at first, it's not going to change any of the restrictions. So even if you're vaccinated, you still have to do all the same masking, distancing. We'll have to do all the same restrictions in restaurants and elsewhere. And that's going to continue until the best models right at this point are we're going to have to get up to about 70% of the population being vaccinated before the pandemic will really come under control. And even then, we'll probably still see outbreaks. But there'll be outbreaks that'll be much easier to control. So we don't know when this, how long it's going to take for the vaccine to really bring things to a conclusion. There is talk of so-called vaccine passports. Very likely the airlines will be interested in that. And there'll probably be occupations that require vaccination as well. But that's often the future. Right now, in the first waves of vaccinations, it's all going to be voluntary. No one will be compelled to be vaccinated, and it will all be done, you know, based on informed consent. Two other questions. One is asking about these new CDC guidelines for quarantine, which we've seen a lot of confusion about. In addition to our standard 14-day quarantine, the CDC put out some recommendations about 10 days or even 7 days with a test. And so we looked over those at Washington State. We came out with an official revision of these that we adopted last Friday. And so we'll be putting that out on our website today. And basically what it says is that, you know, if you've been exposed to a confirmed case, it's 14 days is still the best and the most protective quarantine. And in fact, it's what we're going to require for people who are in high-risk situations. So if you're a caregiver of someone who's at risk of COVID complications, if you work in a long-term care facility or hospital, we will require you to do 14-day quarantine. In some cases, 10 days might be sufficient, and it's going to be very rare that we would ever recommend that someone quarantine only for 7 days with a test. Because what we know is if you do that, you still have about a 5% risk of transmitting the infection. And that's a pretty high risk, especially if you're working with vulnerable populations. And finally, the The last question and the easiest, what is the recommended time period for isolation for a person who tests positive on PCR but has no symptoms? And the answer to that is 10 days. So our isolation period for confirmed infection is either 10 days from your onset of symptoms, or if you have no symptoms, then 10 days from when the test turned positive. And that's actually the day you had the test, not the day it was reported. So that's it for this week's KPTZ questions.
Great, very informative. Thank you to the listeners of KPTZ for those good questions and for the wisdom and the answers. And are there any last questions for Dr. Locke before we pass it off to Willie? All right.
Well, that was pretty exhaustive.
It was. All right. Willie Vince, how are we doing in Department of Emergency Management?
Good. No, continue to do fairly well, still pretty confident in our personal protective equipment stock. I mentioned a little bit maybe a week or two ago that we had received about 45,000 more N95s from the State Emergency Operations Center. We've gotten those distributed out almost entirely to all of our first response partners. And we replaced a couple agency stock of the less desirable KN95s with those new N95s that were coming in. And then we were able to distribute those KN95s to some partners lower on the Department of Health's PPE prioritization list. So that had a little bit of a trickle-down effect, again, getting some of our primary partners on N95s and then redistributing those other ones. That's mostly the big kind of operational update from the EOC. I wanted to thank Dr. Locke and the work that he and public health are doing in terms of the vaccine planning, and then obviously Jefferson Healthcare helping to take the lead on that. So I just really wanted to thank them. A little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. The only other piece I wanted to touch on, again, we have a little bit of light that we're starting to see, but what Dr. Locke said, we are in a pretty dark time still. In terms of we're in the midst of winter, we're in the midst of a major surge. So wanted to reinforce that messaging that we're still in crunch time, even though there's some reason to be optimistic now. And really just want to encourage folks to put their heads down and power through this as we try to get towards the spring. And also just wanted to reinforce that we still, really need to continue to support our local businesses. They've been working just as hard as everyone else trying to maintain safe environments. It's unfortunate that our current round of restrictions is going to be going through the new year. I know that continues to hurt some of our local businesses. So whatever folks can do to support them, I really want to encourage them to do that in your holiday celebrations. Obviously, we want you to stick within your household. But if you can pick up dinner from a local business and bring it home. I knew one person that was supporting local businesses by buying a holiday meal and then actually dropping that off with some of their neighbors. They had one individual who lives alone. They were dropping off a meal around Christmas. I'm not Christmas Day, but around there for them. And then there was another family in the neighborhood that was struggling financially due to the pandemic. A bread earner had lost their source of income. So this person was dropping off a meal for them to help them out a little bit, spread some holiday cheer, as well as, again, support for our local businesses who are struggling to power through it. So wanted to share that, wanted to provide some encouragement to everyone to, again, put your head down and then help support each other. And, hopefully we'll... as this vaccine starts to roll out, we're making progress. There's some light. So all I wanted to say.
Great. Thank you, Willie. Very positive message. Go ahead, Philip.
One question back to Dr. Locke. I think you mentioned regarding senior care centers that Walgreens and CVS were being tapped at the state level. Since they don't have a presence in Jefferson County, is that still the plan that they will be administering to the residents of long-term care centers?
Yes, it is. Is that there's a special allocation of vaccine for the residents of long-term care facilities. We have four facilities in Jefferson County that meet that definition. It's not clear yet how they're actually going to administer it, whether they will send contract nurses to the facilities or whether the staff of the facilities will be responsible. We've not been asked to take on that task. We've actually been asked to do the staff for the long-term care facilities, which we think is a real high priority. So fortunately, in Jefferson Healthcare's allocation has enough vaccine to cover those staff. And we've already fortunately had just a very small outbreak in one of our facilities, which we were able to contain pretty rapidly. But it's such a high-risk setting that's very top of our priority list. So we're expecting that will occur. The staff will be vaccinated this week or early next week, and the residents will be vaccinated next week. And if they need our assistance, we'll figure out a way to do that. But right now, I believe it's actually CVS is the pharmacy that's contracted for Jefferson County.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I'm curious if either of you have heard any data on some of the more kind of social consequences of the pandemic. At some point we had heard we were seeing an increase in domestic violence calls, attempted suicides. Any data for us on those fronts?
Go ahead, Wally.
I can touch a little bit briefly on that. And we are seeing an increase in calls for service, kind of both to law enforcement and to some mental health organizations. Domestic violence has been impacted by the pandemic. I think I mentioned early on that early in the pandemic, as during the most severe lockdowns, folks were being sequestered in their home, so that calls for service were actually down because the abused couldn't get away from their abusers to actually make that call for help. So since then, we have seen an uptick as things have opened up a little bit. They've been able to, separate themselves and make that request. So we've seen a little bit of an uptick there. As kids have gone back to school, oftentimes they reach out for help to a trusted teacher, to a trusted counselor. So there's been a little bit of an uptick there, as kids again have been separated from their potential abuser. Specifically though, the holiday season is also a time of the year when we see an uptick in domestic violence and those types of abuse. And so between the current rent restrictions as well as the holiday season coming up, we're expecting to see that boost a little bit more. So there, obviously, face-to-face meetings are difficult right now. There are hotlines that you can call and ways that you can set up appointments with either a mental health counselor. Obviously, if someone is in sort of direct danger, call local law enforcement at your first available opportunity, or reach out to a trusted confidant, again, like a school teacher or a counselor, etc. We are seeing a boost. This has impacted folks on their mental health as they've stayed isolated at home. The loss of income for a lot of folks has been a major stressor. As a result, pretty much across the board, we're seeing additional calls for assistance to things like domestic abuse, mental health struggles, et cetera.
Yeah, we're also we're seeing increased substance abuse. Emergency room visits, opiate overdose. Mental health professionals are very concerned about suicide risk at the holidays, which goes up in the holidays, even in a non-pandemic year. And now with all these additional stressors, and they're trying to prepare for it. They're trying to do extra kind of efforts and counseling to help people get through what will be, perhaps the roughest holiday season in their lives.
Yes, Willie, at the JPREP meeting Friday, you did quite a long talk about the new hazard mitigation plan. I presume that pandemics will have a bigger section this time.
read it last time. I was kind of the proofreader for the Board of County Commissioners. It's like one of those 3-inch binders, which was a much more interesting read than most people might think, because it has a history of like earthquakes in the county or fires or whatever hazard it is, in addition to what we do about it. But you were talking about doing it in a new format this time, which made it more of a live document rather than something set on a shelf. And this thought might be an opportunity to give people a preview of coming attractions here.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner Sullivan. I appreciate that. And for those of you who don't know, our hazard mitigation...
That will be taking place over the next...
Yes. So those of you who don't know, our hazard mitigation plan is a document we update every 5 years. That's an inventory of local risks and hazards here in Jefferson County, as well as mitigation strategies to help deal with those hazards and risks. And our latest iteration of the plan is going to be due in early 2022. So over 2021, we're going to be working on an update of that plan. And I made a presentation on it to some of our partners on Friday. The previous document was 980 pages long. I appreciate Commissioner Sullivan saying it was more interesting reading than he first imagined. But whatever your opinion, it might be more interesting, but it's still pretty tough to get through. As we go through this update, it's one of my goals to make it a little bit more approachable, since it's 980 pages long, lots of kind of technical talk, lots of policies and regulations and all sorts of unfun stuff. I want to make it more approachable so that people can pick it up and learn about our region and learn about the hazards. In the 2016 update, there was a section on a public health pandemic emergency. So they're a little bit prescient there, but obviously with all the lessons that we've learned throughout this response, all the lessons that we've learned just over the past 4 or 5 years since the previous update, we want to incorporate into that plan, including the section of climate change, which was a new addition to the 2016 plan. So that process will be taking place over the next year. The hazard mitigation plan is on DEM's site. If you do want to go take a look, it's in a section called our library with all of our digital documents. And there are going to be plenty of opportunities for public feedback as we go about and update that plan. So be on the lookout for that. The public comment period will start about mid-year in 2021, so it's just a few months away. But thank you for bringing up our mitigation plan. Again, we're going to be interested in hearing a lot of your feedback, especially with everything we've learned during COVID-19.
Great. Thanks for that. All right. Any last questions, comments for Dr. Locke and Willie? All right. Well, we've got, as always, a busy morning ahead of us. So we'll thank you, Dr. Locke. Thank you, Willie Bitts, for the presentations today. And thank you.
We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19, live from the Jefferson County Board of County Commissioners meeting at the courthouse. A recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. And again, thank you for listening. Thank you, Dr. Locke. Thank you, Willie Bentz. Thank you, commissioners. Well, thanks to all of us. We're trying to get through this. And we're doing the best we can.